From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a ghetto nerd who doesn't fit into the macho culture that surrounds him. We talk with Junot Diaz about his new novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. Oscar is a Dominican-American kid who is overweight, obsessed with science fiction and fantasy, and living in fear that he will die a virgin. The novel tells the history of his family, back to the days they lived under a dictatorship in the Dominican Republic. Diaz moved to New Jersey from the island when he was six. This year marks the 40th anniversary of one of the most famous marches against the war in Vietnam, the March on the Pentagon. Our critic at large, John Powers, will talk about the groundbreaking book and inspired The Armies of the Night by Norman Mailer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of their Classics edition of The Essential Tales and Poems of Edgar Allan Poe, in stores and online at bn.com. From Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Wes Anderson's The Darjeeling Limited, starring Owen Wilson, Adrian Brody, and Jason Schwartzman, in select theaters now. And from NCB, a progressive financial institution serving the nation's cooperative enterprises. Learn more about NCB and other cooperatives at go.coop.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A ghetto nerd at the end of the world is how Junot Diaz describes the main character in his new best-selling novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. Oscar is a Dominican-American kid who doesn't fit into the macho culture that surrounds him. He's overweight, a hardcore science fiction and fantasy man who fears he will remain a virgin for the rest of his life. Reviewing the book in the New York Times, Machiko Kakutani described it as, quote, so original it can only be described as Mario Vargas Llosa meets Star Trek meets David Foster Wallace meets Kanye West. It unfolds from a comic portrait of a second-generation Dominican geek into a harrowing meditation on public and private history and the burdens of familial history, unquote. The novel follows several generations of a Dominican family living under dictatorship on the island and then emigrating to the U.S. Junot Diaz emigrated with his family from the Dominican Republic to New Jersey when he was six. He's now a professor of writing at MIT. Junot Diaz, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a reading from your novel. I'm going to ask you to introduce it for us.
Oh, okay. Thank you. This is the a character named Junior, who's this big, muscle-building knucklehead, describing his college roommate, Oscar, who's this really big nerd who's trying to, you know, find someone to fall in love with. And so this is him talking about poor Oscar and his girl troubles.
Wait, I'm going to stop you for 1 second. I think I should mention that there's going to be references in this reading to names that people won't necessarily know. And every time you hear a name you don't necessarily know, can we assume it's from a science fiction book or a video game?
Yeah, or something from the Dominican Republic. Sometimes you can't tell.
Right, okay. Why don't you do the reading?
Thank you. Did I try to help him with his girl situation, share some of my playerly wisdom? Of course I did. Problem was, when it came to the mujeres, my roommate was like no one on the planet. Dude weighed 307 pounds, for Christ's sake. Talked like a Star Trek computer. The real irony is that you never met a kid who wanted a girl so bad. I mean, I thought I was into females, but no one, and I mean no one, was into them the way Oscar was. To him, they were the beginning and the end, the alpha and the omega, the DC and the Marvel. Holmes had it bad. Couldn't so much as see a cute girl without breaking into shakes. Developed crushes out of nothing. Must have had at least 24 high-level ones that first semester alone. Not that any of these ever came to anything. How could they? Oscar's idea of G was to talk about role-playing games. How crazy is that? My favorite was the day on the e-bus when he informed some hot morena, if you were in my game, I would give you an 18 charisma. I tried to give him advice, I really did. Nothing too complicated, like stop hollering at strange girls on the streets and don't bring up the beyonder any more than necessary. But did he listen? Of course not. Trying to talk sense to Oscar about girls was like trying to throw rocks at Eunice the Untouchable. Dude was impenetrable. He'd hear me out and then shrug. But my favorite conversation that semester? Junior? What? Are you awake? Oscar, if this is about Star Trek. It's not about Star Trek. He coughed. I have heard from a reliable source that no Dominican male has ever died a virgin. You, who have experience in these matters, do you think this is true? I sat up. Dude was peering at me in the dark, dead serious. Oscar, it's against the laws of nature for a Dominican man to die without having sex at least once. That, he sighed, is what worries me.
That's Junot Diaz reading from his new novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. That was a great reading. Thank you for doing that. Oscar is really like the opposite of the stereotype of the macho Dominican man. Do you relate to him? Do you have that level of nerdiness within you?
You know, it's funny because one of the things about being an adolescent, which I kind of drew upon a lot when writing this book, is that you always feel like you're the biggest freak in the world. And so I was nerdy, certainly, up to a certain age, never as crazy as Oscar. But what mattered most was the entire time I was growing up, I always felt like, man, there's never been anyone like me, and there'll never be anyone like me again. And that's probably a good thing.
This isn't the kind of question I usually ask people I've just met, but were you as worried as Oscar that you'd never lose your virginity?
No, I think my problem was I was terrified that I was going to get someone pregnant like the rest of my neighborhood. I mean, it seems like everybody I knew, my sister got pregnant when she was a teenager. A lot of my friends had kids. And so my big terror was that, like, I would get somebody pregnant in high school. That would be the end of all things.
Did you?
No. I'm telling you, the terror shaped my behavior.
So you took precautions.
Yeah, that's a mild way of putting it. Yeah.
What was the kind of man you thought you were supposed to be? What kind of young man did you think you were supposed to be?
Well, I mean, you know, part of what interested me about Oscar was that, like, this character of this kind of Dominican nerd living in New Jersey, he was the far extreme. You know, we have characters like him in all our communities, and it's more crazy when your community's kind of poor, kind of immigrant. People like him really stick out, but he's still there. And when I grew up with a military dad, was in the military in the Dominican Republic, seriously into that kind of discipline. I mean, the old man used to check our shoelaces before we left the house to see that they were, like, tied correctly. And he was really into boxing and really into fighting. And he was the kind of dude who really believed that if boys didn't fight all the time, that, you know, someone was going to take advantage of them or something was going to happen to them. So he always had me and my brothers and the neighboring kids fight all the time. It was like Fight Club without, you know, the cute boys. You were just, like, smacking each other around. Yeah. And so I would go to school, you know, I would go to school. This was in the day when, you know, there was no... People didn't care. You could show up to school with two black eyes and a busted lip, and your teachers would be just like, please turn to page 3. So the kind of boy I was, or that I was told to be, you were kind of this, like, half gladiator, half dude who, you know, was supposed to have as many girls as possible and work until your heart exploded, have no fear, you know? And it was such a weird thing because you're a little kid, of course, and I'm doing all this stuff, and the whole time you're thinking, why don't I feel like this is normal?
What about the part of you that liked to read books and was interested in writing?
Well, I mean, that also came out in some ways. And the one thing my old man is, he always had a shelf of books in the basement. And there were always books about history, about the Dominican Republic, about politics. And I think, you know, in some ways he modeled some bizarre masculine behavior, but he also modeled that reading could be masculine. And that saved me, like, a lot of bizarre contradictions, because I just really got into reading from a young age. You know, I was a kid who had difficulty speaking English when I first immigrated. But in my head, when I read a book, I spoke English perfectly. No one could correct my Spanish. And I think that I retreated to books as a way, you know, to be, like, masterful in a language that was really difficult for me for many years.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Junot Diaz, and his new novel is called The Brief, Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. In your novel, you write a lot about Trujillo, who was the dictator in the Dominican Republic from about, 1930 till his assassination in 1961. And the mother in the book, Oscar's mother, grew up in the Dominican Republic. And she was a beautiful woman when she was young. And you write in the book how it was understood if Trujillo saw a beautiful woman, he would have her as his own. And so fathers would lock up their daughters to prevent that from happening, unless they wanted it to happen, which her father did not.
Yeah, that was more disturbing. Yeah, like, lots of fathers in that historical period happily gave up their daughters to curry favor from the dictatorship.
Mm-hmm. How did you hear stories about this? Was this research or stories handed down by family?
It was a lot of both. I mean, one of the things about, like, what does the Dominican Republic matter to the United States? And more specifically, what does what happened to somebody in Santo Domingo matter to a kid who was born and raised in the U.S.? I mean, in some ways, those are the kind of questions that the narrative is trying to, like, wrestle with. And for me, that was the question. Even when I was growing up, I was left Santo Domingo young, grew up in the U.S. I was far more worried about if I knew all the Michael Jackson lyrics than listening to my folks' stories about what happened in Santo Domingo. And yet the shadow of the past has a way of, like, casting its power over our present, even when we deny it. And I think that what ended up happening to me was I became not aware of that there was all these stories about Trujillo and all these stories about the dictatorship, but that there was an absolute silence about the dictatorship, that no one was actually speaking in any clear way about those 31 years. And, you know, it's sort of like you look at a history book and find 40 pages missing right in the middle. I felt like when I grew up, I was like, this is strange. Both my parents and all their brothers and sisters grew up in this fearsome dictatorship, and yet none of them have spoken about it.
When you started asking them about it, which I assume you eventually did, what kind of stories did they tell you?
Well, you know, you go through a whole number of levels of evasions, you know, where they're just like, ah, that's old stuff. Oh, nothing happened. I had nothing to do with this, you know. But eventually, if you keep going and you're persistent, you begin to get the outlines of what happens when a country is isolated from the rest of the world and is controlled by a single madman. And it was like a nightmare. I mean, I was talking to someone the other day about a story, a very common story that I heard from family members about, you know, like so much of the island was informants that worked for the secret police, and how one man was walking down the street eating an orange and he threw the peel on the ground. At this time, the Dominican Republic was one of the cleanest countries in the world. And the secret police arrested the guy who threw the orange peel on the ground and the three nearest people to him, because they should have apprehended him. And all of them were whisked off to jail.
Was anyone in your family ever, you know, beaten by Trujillo's men or put in jail?
Oh, man, that's the kind of question that would have probably stopped the entire questioning if I pushed too hard. It always felt like there were people in my family who were involved in every piece of that history, but in weirder ways. My father was actually in the military police of the dictatorship and the post-dictatorship. And that was another bizarre thing, where instead of being in some ways having a family member who was a victim of it, my father was part of that kind of structure and brought the regime home in ways that I think if we say in Spanish, impresionante, that were really, it was really powerful. I mean, that regime of the Trujillato, we lived in our house. I mean, we always joke around that in my family we had the dictatorship of our home.
What are some of the ways that he brought it home?
Well, I mean, I just think about lining up all your kids and examining their shoelaces is a perfect example of the Trujillato. I mean, in this period, this is like people would get assassinated. But first, before they were assassinated, Trujillo and his minions would critique their clothing and their dress styles in the newspaper, and the next day he would kill them. And so there was his huge sartorial obsessions. And then again, my father's constant belief that at any moment something catastrophic would come. I mean, it was a country that was always kept on edge, you know?
Was it upsetting for you to find out that your father was in the military of the bad guys?
Well, I mean, the best way to answer that is almost the entire island was complicit in the dictatorship. Some of us were more complicit than others. And so, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, my father was in the military, but, you know, you walked around my neighborhood and people always say, you know, the thing about your father was that your father, like, never pulled his gun, never hurt anybody, which, you know, you couldn't say about everyone else there. And at the same time, I had a mother who was wounded during the U.S. invasion of the Dominican Republic in 1965. So you have people in the family who fit in different places in this kind of historical moment. So, you know, you had a father who was in some ways this pro-dictator kind of guy. You had a mother who was wounded by the U.S. invasion. And as a kid, what do you do with all that history?
How was she wounded?
Oh, well, you know, the main city was bombed. Santo Domingo was bombed repeatedly by American and pro-American forces. So caught up in one of those bombings.
How badly hurt was she?
Just wounded, hospital for a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. When did your parents decide to move to the U.S., to New Jersey more precisely?
When everybody realized that the country was going to enter a very dark period after the U.S. invasion, when it was called the 12 years, everybody began to leave because there were sort of death squads and all sorts of fun stuff. And, my parents, my father, even though he was part of the regime, the military regime, he was like, there's no future here. This country is just going to eat itself. So, he jumped out as soon as he could.
My guest is Juno Diaz. His new novel is called The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Before we get back to Juno Diaz, I'm going to urge you to make a pledge. Here's why. Every station that broadcasts Fresh Air has to pay a fee. That fee goes toward our production budget. This is the way most of the national programs work on public radio. But this means in order for your station to carry Fresh Air listeners have to pledge enough money to cover that fee. So I hope you'll call now. Thank you. My guest is Juno Diaz, the author of the new novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. The main character is a Dominican-American kid who Diaz describes as a ghetto nerd. One of the things I love about your writing is that you combine so many different, styles of speaking in it. There's, Dominican and teen African-American slang, science fiction, fine, elegant writing. But it's also colloquial, borrowed from different... From different cultures. And I guess I'm wondering, did you grow up feeling fluent in all those different cultures?
Yeah, what it is I think that most of us, I know I was exposed to dozens of idioms, dozens of vernaculars. And I think that we just choose to deploy some at any given time. So, at home, out in my neighborhood, we grew up with a very black Puerto Rican English. Then we had to go to an overwhelmingly, mainstream school. In my house, we spoke a very formal Dominican Spanish, but when we were hanging out with other people who spoke Spanish, it was really colloquial. Then we had all the pop culture stuff that knitted us together as a generation. Then we had the language that we just used among our little group. And what I thought was interesting for me when I was writing this book is that, it's so hard in some ways to pull a self together when you have all these disparate threads running through your lives, when you have all these experiences, when you're always asked to choose one or two voices and that's it, because too many would be too many, And in this book, it's like the one place I felt that all the voices that I had run into my head could have at home and could like speak at once and speak together.
And I have to say, as a reader, like, there's certain words in it I don't get. Like, I don't know who the Beyonder is. I assume that's a science fiction reference, but,
Marvel Comics.
Yeah, okay. But I didn't know that. But I figured that's fine, because I get it anyways. I know it's from his kind of like comic book or science fiction world. And there was a few, Spanish Dominican words that I didn't get, but I kind of got it, and it worked for me.
Well, part of the thing that really interested me about the reading experience is that a lot of times we forget that a large portion of what we're reading we don't understand. And most of the time we just skip over it because it's sort of implicit. We don't understand a word, we'll just skip over it and keep going. But, that's like a basic part of communication, unintelligibility. And so if you're an immigrant, you're so used to not being able to understand large chunks of any conversation, large chunks of the linguistic or cultural codes. And part of what I was trying to get at when I was writing this book is that, I wanted everybody at one moment to feel kind of like an immigrant in this book, that there would be one language chain that you might not get and that it was okay. Like, it might provoke in you like a reaction to want to know, and that's good because it'll make you go look and read other books and start conversation. But that life and the experience that most of us have in the world is that we tend to live in a world where a good portion of what we hear, see, and experience is unintelligible to us. And that, to me, feels more real than if everything was transparent for every reader.
There's a lot of bad luck in this book, and the narrator thinks that Oscar and his family have been living under a curse, and the curse is known as the F-U-K-U curse. Now, I wasn't sure whether this is supposed to be a reference to the English expletive that is awfully close to F-U-K-U.
No, not at all.
Or whether it's actually, whether it's actually like a Spanish word or... Like,
no, it's a real word in Santo Domingo. It's like one of these Nigerian words that we got thanks to 400 or 500 years of slavery.
Uh-huh.
It's called fuku, and it means like kind of bad luck, like afflicted bad luck. It's a real word.
Did you expect that other people like me might be confused by that? I'm not sure whether, like, if it was a reference at all to an F-U kind of curse.
You know, it's funny because it's only after the book was published and some people, I realized that in my mind, that word has been in my mind long before I spoke English.
Uh-huh.
So that has priority over the sort of the analog it has in English, you know? And so
Sure. It's
weird. I never thought of it till, and I'm not kidding, in an explicit way till the book was published.
Juno Diaz is the author of the new novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This year marks the 40th anniversary of the March on the Pentagon against the war in Vietnam. Coming up, our critic at large, John Powers, pays tribute to the groundbreaking book the march inspired, The Armies of the Night by Norman Mailer. And we continue our conversation with writer Juno Diaz.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of the new paperback edition of After This by Alice McDermott, author of Charming Billy. From MGM, presenting Lars and the Real Girl, a heartfelt comedy starring Ryan Gosling, now playing in select cities, starts Friday nationwide. And from Audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/freshair.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Juno Diaz, author of the new best-selling novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. The main character is a Dominican-American kid who Diaz describes as a ghetto nerd. The character's parents, and Diaz's parents, lived in the Dominican Republic under a dictatorship. Diaz emigrated with his family to New Jersey when he was six. I think that most Americans know less about Dominican history and Dominicans than they do, say, about Puerto Rican history or Mexican history or, you know, do you know what I mean? So I'm wondering, there were so many stereotypes that Mexicans and Puerto Ricans have to put up with. Do people even know enough about Dominicans to have stereotypes of Dominicans? Were there stereotypes of Dominicans when you were growing up?
Well, no. I mean, I think the first thing is that it assumes that bigotry, you know, differentiates too much. I mean, the funniest thing about being a Latino is that no one actually gets your national origin correct. Being a Latino guaranteed that I was going to be Mexican, Cuban, Puerto Rican. Mm-hmm. Whoever you hated, I was at that time.
How
and
convenient.
The fact that, and the fact that my family is of African descent, I mean, I'm what they would call mulatto back on the island, but I have siblings who were phenotypically black. And so if you hated black people, we fit into that little category too. You know, that's what happens when you come from a place like Santo Domingo.
After you came to the United States when you were six, was it hard to learn English?
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, part of, I think, what comes with the energy of this writing, or at least with the energy that I was trying to bring to the story, was that kind of realization that, you know, the languages that I acquired, you know, it was kind of an interesting process and an interesting struggle. One of the things that happens is I know that the very learning of English for me as a young person, the sort of difficulties I had, also gave me this enormous appreciation, you know, this enormous sense that, you know, language, for many people, it's a commonplace, but for other people, it's a hard-fought, a hard-fought gain. And for me, it was like a real happy triumph to be able to learn a second set of languages. And that was like the wildest little joy when I finally heard myself speaking in English and I sounded like everybody else around me. As a kid, it's hard to underestimate what that feels like.
Was there a period when you were in school when you didn't understand what the teacher was saying because your English wasn't good enough yet?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, one of the things about learning a new language is just extended childhood. You know, when you're a kid and you don't know what the hell the adults are saying, when you're really young, most people don't have that memory. But what happens when you don't know a language that the rest of the world is talking? You either have to have an enormous imagination and you have to have tremendous patience. Because it's a process to learn a language. And you have to have a lot of strength. I think that people underestimate how much strength it takes kids to pick up a new language in a world where no one understands them. And you see, most people just say, these kids, they'll pick it up real quick. Oh, you were just six or seven. It must have been easy. I still see kids all the time, and I think we don't give them enough credit. You know, it takes a lot of courage for these young people to pick up a new language.
Well, it must be almost frightening when you're in school and you know you're going to be judged and, you know, evaluated based on your ability to comprehend and repeat back what the teacher's telling you. And if you can't even understand the language the teacher's speaking in, then you're going to be completely misjudged.
Well, you know, that's the experience of almost all children, you know, in some way or the other. I think that immigrants, of course, it's just more explicit. When you have to learn a whole language, it's completely a new world. It's kind of a new experience. But, you know, you always have these little neighbors who will run over and help you, teach you words. You have teachers who will stop and they'll give you a new word. You know, you'll hear something on TV or a commercial on the street. And, you know, that slow accumulation is this wonderful thing, because one day you wake up and all those little drops have combined into an ocean, you know, and it's this remarkable transformation.
You know, as we were describing earlier, there's a curse that may or may not be responsible for all of the bad luck in the book's main family. And I was wondering if you grew up believing in curses or superstitions at all.
Oh, no, I was a real empirical kid. You know, it's like I had a real tough brother and a real tough sister. And they didn't believe anything that couldn't bite them. But what was great was that, you know, I'm living in a family with, you know, I had this military dad. Everything was real precision. Everything was your word. You know, everything was exact on time. And, you know, I had a grandmother who would turn around and tell me the wildest stories about, you know, you know, these folkloric stories, belief in curses, belief in monsters, the belief in dreams and ancestors. And I felt like, you know, you have these twin traditions running through your head in one household. And even if I didn't believe the stories about my ancestors or about, you know, curses, I was ceaselessly delighted. I loved those things.
My guest is Juno Diaz. His new novel is called The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Juno Diaz. His new novel is called The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. He emigrated with his family to the U.S. from the Dominican Republic when he was six. When we left off, we were talking about stories his grandmother told him when he was a child. So, I mean, obviously, your grandmother must have influenced your interest in storytelling, but what about your father's military discipline side? Do you think that there was part of that that was helpful to you as a writer as well?
Well, you know, I think again, one of the weird things about being an immigrant is that you come to the country to work. You didn't leave the country behind so you could just lamp and, you know, watch TV. And one of the things that happened with all my siblings is that all of us, like, worked like dogs. I mean, from as soon as we could carry something, from as soon as we could lie to someone about our age, we all had jobs. And I think, you know, my dad's discipline certainly was helpful, but the conditioning of being an immigrant, of knowing that your mom is out there cleaning toilets for a living a full day and then coming home and still holding a family together, you know, you have that kind of survival guilt. You're like, your parents did everything for you, and the least you can do is work and try to support that effort. And more than anything, I think, what I do well as a writer, part of it is underpinned by that immigrant desire to work really hard, to kind of honor your parents' sacrifices for coming out to this strange country and in many ways giving up their entire lives. You know, and it's that honoring that really drove me.
Was there a part of your life when you were rebelling and not honoring and thought of them as being old-fashioned or from the old country, from not kind of getting what America was about, from not knowing either the slang or the music or the references?
Oh, yeah, no. We always thought our parents were dumbasses, but, you know, just like immigrants, that didn't mean we stopped working. It was crazy. We could have bad-mouthed our parents and been like, these guys, they don't know nothing. And yet, boy, oh, boy, we'd all still go to our jobs every damn day, deliver our 200 newspapers before dawn, you know, go to our second jobs at night. And so, yeah, no, it was interesting because, you know, You could think one way about them, but our praxis was real, real in line with them.
What were some of the jobs that you held?
Oof, man. My favorite series of jobs was the one year when I was a dishwasher in a Chinese restaurant for dinner. I pumped gas early in the morning, and during the day I worked in a steel mill. And I did these three jobs for a while till I just collapsed from exhaustion. So it was like, you know, this is the kind of stuff you do. But I delivered pool tables for over 10 years. That was wild. That was a great experience because it just gave you access to a whole world, to a whole range of people, you know?
Wow. Were you writing during all of these jobs?
Well, no. I mean, I was reading. More than anything, I think that's what's... When I think about the book and I think about this novel specifically, I'm so interested in sort of the reactions that I'm getting from folks that I just meet at bookstores or folks that I meet in the street, or just people that come up to me and talk to me. You know, if it happens once a month, you're kind of excited, you know. And one of the things for me is that this is a book that's about a love of reading, and it's a book that speaks to people who love reading. And more than being a writer, I feel like I've always been a reader. For me, I write because I love to read so much. What's so fascinating is readers think of books quite differently than, say, critics or, say, academics. I mean, If you look at most readers' bookshelves, they have incredible diversity of books, of texts, of voices, and they live comfortably with it, you know? And that's part of what I was trying to do in this book, is see if I could get all these different highs and lows and middles. And could they fit together in a book the way that all those different books in my youth fit together in a bookshelf? And I wasn't sitting here dividing, these are the great 100 books and these are the junk. That's not the way I read.
So is it thrilling for you to not only be a writer, a published writer, but to be getting like such great reviews, having read all your life and thought about language so much? I mean, did you expect that you'd actually be able to pull it off?
I think, you know, my sense is always what's the next project. I mean, I think most of us, I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe I grew up in a different world, but most of the people I grew up with, we could never believe that we could do what we ended up doing. You know, it's like immigrants. I mean, if my mother could never have imagined how she would start on a farm in Santo Domingo and end up in a house right across the George Washington Bridge in New Jersey with these children who are all like professionals in some ways, you know. And I know I never thought that, to be completely honest, I never thought that I would have the career I have now. I mean, it's such a huge blessing. But there's a part of me in the end that knows that any kind of accolades and any kind of praise that's just provisional. If you're serious about this tradition, if you're serious about participating in writing and in reading, you know that what you're really about is that you're trying to build a relationship with a reader that you'll never meet and that you'll never see. And you want that relationship. You want a book to last on a shelf longer than the fireworks of people saying, oh, you done well, son. You did well. I mean, really great art has to last. And you never know if you've done really great art, because there's plenty of people who were praised in their days that we don't read anymore at all.
I'm assuming the answer to this will probably be yes, but I'll ask it anyways. Did your parents' English get good enough so that they could actually read your books?
Oh, no, not at all. My mother only speaks Spanish. She doesn't read English at all. She thinks what I do is, she finds my work to be, she's like, man, this is crazy. You are our smart one. We wanted you to be a doctor.
Is it frustrating that they can't share in your books? They can't, you know, your mother can't read them.
Well, no, I mean, she'll read them when they get translated into Spanish. But I mean, I think that it's so many of us do stuff that's, our professions are so incredibly specialized. I mean, I teach at MIT. Mm-hmm. My students, the average human being couldn't even begin to talk to my students about what their professional interests are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've got kids who do a high energy physics. You ever try to talk to a high energy physicist about what they're doing? I mean, I feel like, man, I can't even begin to understand the second word that comes out of their mouth. My mom at least says, well, I got my son's book. I could put it on my shelf and show it to relatives, you know?
Right, absolutely.
So, I mean, sure, you know, I mean, everybody wants to be perfectly transparent and wants everybody to know, you know, your parents to know everything about you. But reality is, it's a new world of specialization, Terry. It's like, you're lucky if people can even remember your job title.
Juno Diaz, it's really been great talking with you. Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much.
Juno Diaz is the author of the new novel, The Brief Wondrous Life of Oscar Wao. This month marks the 40th anniversary of the March on the Pentagon, a demonstration against the war in Vietnam that was chronicled and mythologized in Norman Mailer's book, The Armies of the Night. The book was published a year after the march and won a National Book Award and a Pulitzer Prize. Mailer is now 84 and is in the hospital recovering from lung surgery. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, is a great admirer of the Armies of the Night, so much so that she's organized an anniversary conference on the march and the book it inspired. The conference will be held tomorrow at Georgetown University, where she teaches. When our critic at large, John Powers, heard about the conference, he reread the book and has these thoughts.
If you only know the 60s from old news footage, you might think there were demonstrations going on every single minute. Civil rights marches, free speech rallies, throngs protesting the war in Vietnam. This wasn't true, of course, but it's also true that some of that era's protests still endure in our national mythology. One of them is the March on the Pentagon that took place exactly 40 years ago on October 21st, 2 years into the Vietnam War. After a ritual burning of draft cards, 50,000 marchers made their way from Washington to the steps of the Pentagon. It was designed as a peaceful, if high-spirited, protest. Abby Hoffman said they would make the Pentagon levitate. And for the most part, it was. But along the way, protesters taunted and threw fish at the soldiers guarding the Pentagon. Innocent protesters got clubbed, many of them women. And by the end, 683 people had been arrested and 50 injured. It would be wrong to call this march a turning point in the war. Troop levels in Vietnam actually went up to over 500,000 the next year. But it did announce a huge change in how Americans thought about the war. It galvanized the opposition. And the march did something else. It inspired a great book, Norman Mailer's The Armies of the Night. Subtitled History as a Novel, The Novel as History, it gives us this event as seen through the eyes of a brilliant writer with an unparalleled feel for his historical moment. His synapses are exploding like fireworks on the 4th of July. Writing in third person, Mailer portrays himself as a comically vainglorious novelist. He gets arrested for rushing the Pentagon, is tossed into a paddy wagon with a Nazi, and spends the night in jail, missing much of the action. Along the way, he riffs wonderfully on everything from the idiocy of U.S. policy in Asia to the tediousness of parties thrown by liberals. Well aware that he's witnessed only a small part of what actually happened at the Pentagon, Mailer also offers a historical reconstruction of what went on in his absence. The Armies of the Night is written with such enjoyable brio that it's sometimes easy to forget that Mailer, like the other demonstrators, was dead serious in opposing the war. But this becomes clear if you watch Dick Fontaine's revealing 1968 documentary, Will the Real Norman Mailer Please Stand Up? Here, for instance, Mailer has just been released from jail and uses the steps of the Virginia courthouse as his pulpit.
If you were sure the exact same thing would happen to you that happened today, would you do this again?
Yeah, I'd have to. It isn't a matter of doing it, you know, because it's agreeable or disagreeable. I thought I saw the time had come where one had to go to jail as a... and take a token sentence as a symbol of one's opposition. Now, what I'm really concerned about and afraid of is that this war doesn't end in the next year or two. I think there are going to be a few of us who are going to have to take longer sentences, because I think, and I'm not making any predictions, I just have a feeling in my bones that the ante is going to go up. Demonstrations are going to get stronger, the resistance to the war is going to get larger, and the people who are prosecuting the war are going to become more intense, from my point of view, hateful in their prosecution of it.
I'd like to end with a sermon, if I might. While I'm not a Christian, I happen to be married to one. And there are times when I think that the loveliest thing about my dear wife is her unspoken love for Jesus Christ. The closest I've ever come to Jesus is through knowing her. And they are burning the body and the blood of Christ in Vietnam, dear fellow Americans. This war in Vietnam will destroy the foundation of the Republic, which is its love and trust in Jesus Christ. Amen.
Listening to these prophetic words, one is reminded that there was a time in this country when writers were thought, rightly or wrongly, to possess a certain authority. Novelists were on The Tonight Show, for crying out loud. The March on the Pentagon was enhanced by boasting such literary lions as Mailer, poet Robert Lowell, and critic Dwight MacDonald. It gave the occasion a certain gravitas, and it helped attract the media. These days, who'd even notice if Jonathan Franzen, Rita Dove, and John Leonard were fronting a peace march? Where's George Clooney? Where's Leo? But the greater change lies in how Americans view political life. Back in 1967, the Vietnam War was still supported by well over half the country, and the media hadn't yet turned on it. Still, tens of thousands marched on the Pentagon because politics was seen as a personal way of fighting for the soul of the country. People believed it was possible to reshape society by taking to the streets in a display of moral and political unity that would be covered by all three of the TV networks. These days, Americans have lost faith in the power of such displays, or simply can't be bothered. Last spring, veterans led another march on the Pentagon. Only 10,000 people showed up, and the event disappeared without a trace. This in a country where opposing the war is by far the majority opinion. And anti-war Americans are positively obsessed by what's happening in Iraq. But the style of protest today is different. Instead of taking to the streets, most people expend their political energies at home reading blogs, firing off emails, cursing Fox News or Keith Olbermann, and sending donations to favorite causes. While I'd never say that this new digital politics is all wrong, I will make one small prediction. No figure as great as Norman Mailer will ever write a book about it.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and is our critic at large. This is Fresh Air. We often talk about the intersection of politics and culture on our show. We know that our public radio audience wants to hear about issues and popular culture in depth and in their full complexity. We hope these interviews and reviews raise interesting questions for you and inspire conversations, maybe even spirited arguments, with friends and family. But right now, to keep these conversations going, we need you to make a pledge. Thank you. In the 1960s and 70s, rock and roll was a worldwide phenomenon in ways that Western pop audiences never knew. Even today, regional styles from that era are still coming to light. Critic Milo Miles reviews a new anthology of a previously obscure rock style, psychedelic chicha from Peru.
Electric guitars and rock and roll have become such background fixtures in American culture, it's hard to imagine they were once the shock of the new. 40 and more years ago, that amplified racket was not just forbidden sexy, but hip, modern, urban, the now. It's even harder to grasp just how much the same effect was felt in Africa, Asia, and South America. Specifically, no one knew that at the same time Simon and Garfunkel were introducing American audiences to Peruvian folk with El Condor Pasa, so-called chicha bands were introducing Peruvian audiences to garage rock and roll. A superb collection of these vintage sides has now been released as The Roots of Chicha, Psychedelic Cumbias from Peru. Like rock, chicha began as low-rent party music in bars that catered to scruffy fans with rising incomes, in this case from the Peruvian oil boom of the late 1960s. Also like rock, chicha was a mad mix of styles, actually more the dance-style cumbia from Colombia than big beat from America. But rock fans today will immediately relate to the killer guitar hooks and the plain-spoken let's go quality of the vocals. these hearty, rough-and-ready vocals don't convey much in the way of emotion that gets past the language barrier. It's a shame there's no lyric translations in the package. The liner notes say that a frequent theme is the clash of old and new social mores, the traditional ways of the country versus the fluid ways of the city. But you can hear what the newfangled amps and electric guitars always declared. Now is our time. This day belongs to us. Just consider this saucy version of Beethoven's Für Elise. Fans everywhere got the same message. Roll over, Beethoven, and tell Tchaikovsky the news.
Milo Miles lives in Boston. He reviewed The Roots of Chicha on the Barbez label. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Ya se ha muerto mi abuelo. Ay, ay, ay. Ya se ha muerto mi abuelo. Ay, ay, ay. Tomando trago. Ay, ay, ay. Tomando trago. Ay, ay, ay.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, some of the top fake newsmen of our time, from The Daily Show and The Colbert Report. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.